It's time to take your relationship with money past the place of uncertainty and complexity through the challenging transitions to that good place where your money is doing exactly what you want for your life. This is Getting There, the Financial Good Place podcast with Esther Szabo, CFP, and Eric Shea, CFA, from Gates Pass Advisors. Esther and Eric guide you to the good place of financial fulfillment and security. Are you ready to get there?
Hello and welcome to Getting There with Esther Szabo from Gates Pass Advisors. Esther, how are you?
Well, I'm doing well, and I'm also joined by Eric Shea, my partner in crime here at Gates Pass Advisors.
Yes.
Hello there.
Yeah, I've got both of you on the podcast today, so that means I'm going to learn twice as much. Or whatever.
Maybe four times as much.
Yes, it multiplies like that. So what are we learning about today? What are you guys going to be talking about?
Well, we've had quite a volatile start to the year in the markets, and we want to talk about that. What is going on in the stock market, and should people be worried? Long story short, now people will click off. We don't think so. But we're going to go through in terms of what's been going on and the three areas that we think are really critical to be that are sources of this being the inflation numbers we're seeing, stock valuations, and movements by the Fed. So year to date this year, we're recording this in kind of getting towards the middle of February, not quite. The S&P 500, which is the main gauge of the U.S. stock market, is down between 5% and 6%. And again, it's only February, so it's early on in the year. NASDAQ's down 10 to 11%. The Dow Jones Industrials is down 3 to 4%, between 3 and 4%. And even the bond index, as measured by the U.S. aggregate bond ETF, is also down to 3%, 2 to 3%. I don't want people to get freaked out thinking I'm saying 34% or 23%. These are all single-digit numbers except for the NASDAQ, which is down between 10 and 11. And all of those numbers are year-to-date. So we're going to talk about, we're going to kick this off first because everyone's seen these headlines about inflation. We're seeing levels not seen for about 40 years. Currently, inflation is running at an annual rate of 7%. And we know that our economy is about two-thirds driven by consumer behavior, by you, me, both of the Erics, their families, your families, buying stuff, ordering stuff, etc. And what else has been grabbing headlines? These ongoing supply chain disruptions. So I'm going to toss it to Eric to talk about the connection between these.
Thanks. Yeah, if we think about it from a very very top level, 10,000 foot view, what we really have here is just a simple imbalance between supply and demand. If we take a look at this recession that we hit back with the pandemic, when the economy shut down in March of 2020, and then it started to open up, we all know that we had a record recovery from that shutdown, and which really made this recession unique to other recessions. Typically, if we take a look at the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, and 2009, there was a sudden shutdown and a sudden drop off in the health of the consumer and the suppliers. But it took literally years before both the consumer and the suppliers came back to full strength. And so they kind of moved stride in stride, gradual growth. What made the pandemic recession different was that on average, not everybody, but on average, the consumer was actually coming out of this recession in a better place, with a higher net worth, with higher savings, with lower debt service. And so the consumer, once this economy opened back up, was ready to start buying. And one of the other unique things about this was what they were buying changed drastically as well. Where prior to the pandemic, we were far more of a service-based consumption, travel, hotels, restaurants, movie theaters. But when we couldn't buy those things anymore and we still had money, people started focusing on goods. And so as we've seen this recovery, we've seen spending on goods raise drastically while the spending on services has been certainly more moderate. But that change in demand has kind of surprised the suppliers. And so now they don't know how to forecast and keep up with that ongoing demand. And so it causes supply issues. So when demand is so much higher than supply, you get a situation of rising prices, which is inflation. Another added kind of hurdle in there are these labor issues that we're dealing with. And I guess, Esther, what do you see as some of these issues that have been hitting the labor market?
Yeah, it is another issue of demand versus supply. Demand of openings versus workers available. You may have heard the term, the Great Resignation. There were a number of employees who, after the shutdown and during all that's come after, said, who might have been in their early 60s, late 50s, mid 60s, who had planned to work a few more years, but with the fact of everything being shut down and that choice being removed from them, basically said, you know what, I think I'm going to go ahead and just retire. I'm going to resign from this position and just be done. And by comparison, you mentioned also the financial crisis in 2009, that huge recession that we went through then. At that time, at the end of it in 2009, there were more than 26 million people looking for a job, with only about 2.5 million job openings. So to contrast that with what's going on now, currently there's theoretically a little over 12.5 million people available to fill 11 million job openings. And this is the smallest gap on record. So what happens? Again, there's wage inflation. Big companies like Amazon and John Deere are providing increases to attract and maintain workers. And you've probably seen it in your community, Eric Johnson. We see it here. There's help wanted signs mm-hmm. everywhere. There's a lot of jobs available. So, Eric, it sounds like it's a great environment. Wages are up. Consumers are spending. Why is the Fed feeling like anything needs to change? It sounds great.
It's the Fed has two mandates. Number one, to ensure long-term full employment, which that doesn't mean 100% employment, but it usually assumes more of like a 3% unemployment rate, which is kind of the sustainable long-term employment rates. And then to control inflation. Those are the two jobs, simple, right? And one of the main tools they have to help kind of control that is what you hear a lot about, the Fed funds rate. And that really is basically, you can think of it as the cost of money. Because when you go and you get a mortgage and a bank lends you, you know, X hundred thousands of dollars at a certain rate, that bank doesn't necessarily have that cash on hand itself. So that bank is actually borrowing from whether it's the federal government or other institutions, but that lending rate that they borrow from each other is set and determined by the Federal Reserve. And so when the Federal Reserve ups the price of money, raises interest rates of what they lend at, it costs the banks more money on their capital. So it kind of increases their costs and their risks. So that dampens some of the availability of demand. So if we look at that, if we look at the way things are now, unemployment rates are actually below average for the 5 years prior to the pandemic. And so that means, generally speaking, the consumer is still healthy and has some flexibility to absorb additional costs. But inflation is about three times average of what we've seen prior to the pandemic. And so the Fed is looking at this, okay, we have our rates set basically as low as we can go. So how can we help fight this inflation? And seeing that the consumer's in a good spot, if they raise interest rates, the biggest effect will be on inflation and tamping down that demand. And so that's the talk of the Fed, is that, hey, you know, the economy's not in a bad spot, but we just need to pump the brakes a little bit. And so by increasing the price of money, yes, it makes banks and corporations access to capital more expensive. So it'll hurt the price to earnings, or it'll hurt their earnings a little bit. But that's not to say that it'll cause them to have negative earnings and be losing money. It's just that their earnings won't be growing as fast.
And you mentioned for corporations, it's also for individuals, right? Mortgages, auto loans, et cetera.
Exactly. The ripple effects through the economy are widespread.
So that thought is that will reduce demand, and then prices will then slow a little bit accordingly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so you mentioned about valuations in the stock market. And this is one of those words that I know the ordinary person goes, oh gosh, this is that financial stuff. I can't, you know, you guys are using these terms. I always, you know, we talk about how the market is valued. You hear the words, oh, it's overvalued or undervalued, or a particular stock is overvalued or undervalued. And that's just to give a sense of it's often equated with, is the stock market risky at this point? And actually, the market is always risky. It's never a sure bet because there are so many factors that can impact it on a short-term basis. On a longer-term basis, 5 years to 10 years longer, the market has been consistently reliable in terms of its returns. But on a short-term, the market is not reliable because of all of these different issues. So we had the example a couple of weeks ago, Facebook, now known as Meta Platforms, was down 35%. Those shares of that company were down 35% in, well, year to date, and they lost 26% in value in 1 day. And that didn't have anything to do really with what the Federal Reserve was doing. It had to do with about reduction in profits, which is really rare for Facebook. So right there, if something is rare, it's off trend, that raises a red flag. And that was due to a combination of increased expenses and investing a lot of money back into the company and decreasing revenue that was reported. And a stock like Facebook, that's been one of the top five companies, especially during the pandemic, in terms of share price appreciation and consistently topping expectations, it grabs headlines when a stock like that falls as dramatically as it did. And this is what happens in the markets when, I'm going to set that one aside, just mentioning that that was a big headline grabber that can make people feel nervous, because technology shares have led through this pandemic. We turned to technology because we relied on them for school, for work from home, for exercise, for shopping, for entertainment. And moving past the pandemic, what we're anticipating is a shift in the types of stocks that are attractive to investors. So during the pandemic, technology stocks led the way. Without technology stocks, we would not have seen the returns we've seen on the S&P 500 through the pandemic. And now, as the pandemic is moving, hopefully, to resolution and hopefully into our rearview mirror, there's other types of stocks that are getting more attention in terms of their usefulness. Stocks that pay a dividend for that kind of income coming in, as well as share price appreciation. But I'm going to put a pin in that. When we have these issues that Eric and I have been talking about, that the Fed is moving to increase interest rates, the thought is how much? 3 to 4 times this year.
Yeah, right? Potentially even 5.
Starting next month in March. So the market often initially responds to that by doing what we've seen, which is sell off in anticipation of reduced profits. And the reduced profits are due to labor cost increases, to some extent to the debt costs increasing, and just again for a shift of investor comfort into different sectors.
Well, I think one of the big drivers of the volatility that we've seen with the talk of a bump in interest rates is really a direct result of, kind of as Esther and I mentioned, that, oh, there could be, you know, 3. Maybe 4, even 5 interest rate. Mm-hmm. We're, that uncertainty of if the market is always a forward-looking environment and it's more optimistic, the more it can, quote, predict how things are going to go or how comfortable it is in its forecast. And when the Fed comes out and says, you know, this inflation we originally thought was going to be shorter term and we thought the market and the economy could handle it, but it's gone longer than expected and we're starting to look at this, they're very vague on, okay, what's it going to take to tamp down this inflation? And so, and they're not giving any indicator of whether they think, oh, you know, this could be, you know, just several quarter point bumps, or, hey, do we see a half point move. Like, there's so many different changes that they could play to bump this down that the market can't feel comfortable in its prediction of that. So oftentimes when that uncertainty is introduced, we see some volatility like we've seen recently. But if we actually, if we look at the market in non-recession periods where the Fed is raising rates, the market actually takes that as a good sign. And as the raise rate, the raising rates come to fruition, the market is more comfortable with that level of certainty. And it's a sign from the Fed that, hey, the economy's in a good spot. We just got to pump the brakes and stop it from overheating.
And then there's always this concern that the Fed will overdo it, mm-hmm. that they're going to move too quickly, too fast. And this happened, I believe, in 19. Where the Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, was saying, yeah, we have to move interest rates up, have to move interest rates up. And the market really took a downturn.
That was the fourth quarter of 2018 we saw a 20% pullback because they started a little too aggressively on the interest rates. And again, you can just see how emotional the market is in the short term, and that the unexpected happenings can swing the market in the short term. But at the end of the day, here we are years later, and we've just seen remarkable growth.
And if people moved out, if investors moved out at that time, just like so many others, would have missed out on incredible returns that followed. Now, the other thing that happens when interest rates go up is that bond interest rates go up as well. So let's talk a little bit about the impact of these increases on bonds, because the market can get really nervous when rates increase because bond yields are rising.
Exactly. And so for those of you holding bond mutual funds or ETFs, you've probably seen an effect on the principal value of those funds. Because if we think about this, again, from a top level, if I'm holding a bond, if I own a bond that pays 2%, and the Fed comes out and says, okay, we're going to bump interest rates by 0.5%. And so now your new bonds that are coming out, instead of paying 2%, are going to be paying 2.5%. That makes my bond worth less in the market. So if I wanted to go out and sell that bond, I would have to sell that bond at a price so that it would look like it was paying 2.5%.
And it's not worth less, it's just worth less. Fewer dollars than it was before.
Yes. And so you're going to see a swing in that market. And that's where one of the advantages of owning bonds directly comes through. This is a small side note, that if you own a bond directly, if you own a 30-year treasury note paying 5% interest, while if interest rates go up, the market value, what you could sell that bond for, is drops and could drop below full value. But if you hold that bond all the way to maturity, you're guaranteed to get your money back and receive your interest payments. When you hold a bond fund, either an ETF or a mutual fund, you don't have that principal guarantee that if you just hold that fund long enough, you'll get your principal back. So it's a slight difference in how you get your exposure to bonds. But that being said, in a rising rate environment, even if, given our current environment where we've seen the treasury rate jump from just below 1% all the way up to even just below 2% here in recent times, that treasury bond yield is still not enough to even beat inflation right now. Even long-term target inflation, where the 10-year treasury is paying 2%, the target long-term inflation is closer to 2.5%, 3%. So it's hard to create that stable wealth maintaining income from bonds like we used to do and used to be so comfortable with back in the 90s and early 2000s. And so in practical terms, if you've got a $2 million portfolio where we used to think, oh, you know, I'll just go put it in treasuries, get 5% on that, and poof, look at that, I have $100,000. That was a good way to work it. But now if you have a $2 million portfolio and want to put it into 10-year treasuries, that 2% is only going to give you $40,000 a year.
And it's one of the things that's really challenging for clients and investors when they're looking at, how do I generate the income that I need in retirement without dealing with this pesky stock market? And we were all trained, those of us in the industry, that as one gets older, one shifts to bonds, and that makes life more secure, which, yeah, your principal can be secure, but your after-tax, after inflation, you're locking in a negative return. And that is not secure, because if you have a negative return, you're going to have to go into that principal and bring that down, which it creates this cycle of less principal, generates less yield, then you have to go into more principal to meet your needs. So a lot of what we're talking about and working with clients on is these bond portfolios that are a lot more diversified, very little exposure to U.S. treasuries, individual bonds held. I used to, 20 years ago, as Eric was talking about, in the 2000s, I used to build my own bond ladders and was able to do that. But the yields are so low, you want to save every penny on trading costs. And we talk a lot at Gates Pass about transparency of fees, transparency of costs. Bond trading is one place you don't really get to see how the pricing works. And we're going up into a little bit of a divergent here, but it is so important in the bond market. It's basically just prices that are shaved off of the principal before somebody ever gets it, or dollars that are shaved off to pay for the one placing the trade. And one has to save as many of those dollars as possible to get the best pricing, which in turn creates the best yield. And so it really requires, for something as quote unquote simple as a bond portfolio, it requires more attention than it ever did before to make it a competitively priced, competitively yielding part of one's portfolio.
Yeah. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about kind of the uncertainty that this inflation and the Fed has introduced into the markets. There are some other really just more world events and dynamics and U.S. happenings that have been adding in some additional uncertainty into the market that's caused some of this volatility as well. Esther, what are some of those?
Well, we've all heard about Ukraine. Russia may be invading Ukraine, and President Biden has sent troops over to address that should that come to pass. And the issue with Russia invading Ukraine is that could really impact energy exports to Europe and creates another layer of uncertainty. There are issues with China and the U.S. that continue, as well as with Iran. So there's a number of geopolitical issues that there always are. I have, and I think this is true for you, Eric, I don't think there's been a day in our respective careers where there has not been a particular geopolitical concern, but that's the latest one in the headlines, and again, creating uncertainty. We've also got upcoming midterm elections this year, which can also create uncertainty in terms of what will Fed policy be, monetary policy, and the federal government's policy in terms of creating money that really helped people get through the pandemic, what will happen with taxes, et cetera. A lot of uncertainty based on the leadership. And the concern that I mentioned earlier, the Fed may overdo these interest rate increases. The market hasn't got confidence that will be timed well. Markets hate uncertainty, and then they sell off. Now, all of these, don't forget, they create opportunity. The market is one place that people get terrified of a sale. When prices drop 10, 15, 20%, people head for the hills. And I love this quote by Warren Buffett. He said, "You pay a very high price in the stock market for a cheery consensus. Uncertainty is the friend of the buyer of long-term values." So Eric, it's not abnormal that we've gotten a little bit pacified here, that we've had great years in the market to think, well, the market just always goes up. In behavioral finance, it's recency bias. Whatever has just happened recently, we think will continue. And then when it shifts, we get nervous. But what's typically what we see?
Yeah, exactly. The beginning of the year has kind of been a whipsaw. You know, it's probably been that where we've ended up is probably seems a bit exaggerated. You know, Esther, you mentioned that the S&P for the year is down 5 to 6% right now. And that it may seem like we've moved more than that. And that's really for two reasons. Number one, since we haven't seen a pullback in the market of more than 5% the market being the S&P 500, since March of 2020. So since we started this pandemic, we've only seen 5% or less pullbacks. And so now we're starting to, we're testing that again. So that gets people a little anxious. And then just the day-to-day volatility of the markets. I was looking at some information earlier today. And if we just look at January, the NASDAQ, of the 21 days in January, 7 of those days had moves of more than 2% up or down. And even in one of those days, we saw the market go from being down 1.5% to closing up above 2%. And those types of swings can make these rides of 5-6% seem significantly bigger than what they actually are. So, you know, what we're seeing, and if you pull anything from this, is that there's always uncertainty in the market. Like Esther said, you know, there's always risk there. And these short-term moves are not indicative of the long-term consistency of the market. And so when you're investing, and when we here at Gates Pass are recommending investment strategies and allocations, it's with a long-term view, so that, you know, your portfolio is structured in a way that you can manage these short-term, highly volatile periods that we've seen over the last couple of years, so that you can maintain your exposure in the market and participate in the long-run growth.
And what we've been working on for a number of years with our clients, because the market has done so well, the market as measured by the S&P 500, which has been so tech heavy, and we're in a tech heavy community here where we work in Silicon Valley, is how to take capital gains off the table and start reallocating those. It's for many people, just investing in a plain old vanilla S&P 500. Sure, you've done great. Absolutely. It's wonderful. It's low cost, etc. But it is less exposed to some areas that are great values currently, and more exposed to those the high-tech names, which have done fabulous, and that's really wonderful for long-term growth. But as one is looking forward, so we, you know, the market's always looking forward to what it thinks it sees, but it's looking forward at a pretty short-term length of time. We work with our clients to look forward, not just the next market cycle, but for the next 10 years of one's life. And any of us, however old we are, can say, okay, this is where I am now. In 10 years, how old will I be? And is this the portfolio that makes sense for me as I move towards that age versus from where I've come? And really what we're advising our clients as we continue to reallocate as needed to support what the planning and the clients need for their continued stability and growth is, for the most part, to stay the course. This is, as Eric said, this is what the market does. It's just what the market does based on these types of inputs. And the consumer is still healthy. Unemployment is low. We do think the supply chain issue is temporary. I know we said that last year. We think it's temporary just for a longer period of time till this gets worked out. It is easy to shut things down. It is easy to stop things. It is not easy in this global manufacturing environment and with the labor shortages that we have to get things all working smoothly. But even the Fed targets, as Eric mentioned earlier, that in 5 years, the inflation rate will be back to 2.25%, long-term expected to be much lower than where it is now, and that economic growth overall is still robust. It's just coming back to normal levels after rebounding so much after the initial COVID shutdown shock. So with that, we've covered just the areas that we think are critical as we're looking at market volatility, which is expected to continue throughout the year as adjustments are made. But the inflation, stock valuations, the Fed, and just global economic uncertainty through those three particular areas are really feeding into this. But if you have questions about where you're allocated now and would like a portfolio review or to talk with us, we are available to schedule an appointment. And we can also provide a white paper on this content out to you.
Eric and Esther, I absolutely found this riveting. There's so much information to unpack, but I'm going to boil a lot of it down to something, Esther, you and I have spoken about before many times. I blame the media. I'm just going to blame the media.
Right? Absolutely. Yes.
Here's the thing is that if you're listening to this, if you're accessing any news, any information where they make their living by selling commercials, you're getting an agenda. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. What I'm saying is that if they have to buy advertising space or if they sell advertising space, they're trying to get people to watch their show. So they're saying things that are outlandish. Today, you guys absolutely killed it because it was just straight information, you know, factual, giving them such a great foundation to look at what their situation is. And I do ask people to reach out to you. Can you give contact information just one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. The website is gatespassadvisors.com. We have a contact us page there. And the phone number here, people still call 650-797-0280. And Eric is E-R-I-K at gatespassadvisors.com. And I'm Esther, E-S-T-H-E-R at gatespassadvisors.com.
All right. Eric and Esther, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Eric Johnson. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. And of course, our last thank you is always reserved for you, the listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Getting There podcast with Eric Shea and Esther Szabo. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when they come out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it much easier to share these podcasts with your friends and family. Again, thank you so much for listening today. For everyone at Gates Pass Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Getting There, the Financial Good Place podcast. Be sure to follow the podcast on your favorite listening platform to be notified as soon as we release a new episode. Check out the website at www.gatespassadvisors.com for more information. The content is developed from sources believed to be providing accurate information. The information in this material is not intended as tax or legal advice. Please consult legal or tax professionals for specific information regarding your individual situation. The opinions expressed and material provided are for general information and should not be considered a solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security.